From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in New York City over stacks of poetry submissions. Craig Morgan Teicher and Brenda Shaughnessy were reviewing material for Tin House Magazine when they realized their shared love and commitment to the art form. And less than 2 years later, they were married. Since then, Teicher and Shaughnessy have written, they've each written poems about their lives together, lessons they learned growing up, their marriage, and about their young son's injury and disability. In 2012, they told Poets and Writers magazine, quote, "In no small way, our love of and commitment to poetry, especially to each other's, has enabled us to remain hopeful, joyful, and most of all, imaginative through some of the most challenging experiences any parent or any couple could face," end quote. That sentiment is reflected in Craig Morgan Teicher's collection, The Trembling Answers, which was published this year by BOA Editions here in Rochester. Teicher is in town for several events this weekend as part of National Poetry Month. We've had a chance to read some of his work. It's beautiful. In this hour, we're talking to him and others about the art of writing poetry, its value, how it's taught in schools, and the challenge that the Philistines like me have in trying to appreciate and love it, even if we don't know all about the structure of it, because we were just talking about how intimidating that can be. So we've got a lot to talk about. Craig is here. Congratulations on the work here, and thank you for taking the time to be here in studio with us.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Al Abinato is here. He's a poet and director of adult programs at Writers and Books. Al, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
And also here is Banke Awupe-Tu, who's the author of Always Want More. She's written some poetry in her own life, and she's also an educator. Banke, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
I was just talking about whether I could even pick up Craig's work and feel like I'm qualified to weigh in on whether I like it or not. And I really, really like it. But I can't sit here and tell you I understand the form of the structure, what you chose here and there. Does that matter to you?
I think that one of the big problems with how poetry is presented to people is that there's some right way to respond to it. And, the same way that you don't hold people to that kind of a standard with listening to music, I think it's the same with poetry. If it brings you pleasure or some other emotional response, it's working. I mean, there are lots of ways you can read it. Certainly you can spend a lot of time with how it's built and why it's built that way, but that's not the only way in.
Okay, well, I think Banke, before the program began, I stopped her in her tracks because she was on this great rant about, just this very question about how we kind of grow up and the older we get, maybe we start feeling more pressure to have to analyze.
Right, we get boxed in. So when you think about most writers, we enter the field with poetry because it is kind of open and expressive. Yet as we get older, we start to think, like what you were saying, that I need to know certain things before I can fully interact with this. And really, we're kind of killing the industry in that way, because what we're essentially saying is the majority of people don't have the capacity to understand something that is supposed to be a reflection of their lives. So then this becomes something that's only for academics or intellectuals. But in reality, the purpose of poetry is to meet people where they are.
And I think that's beautifully said. But there's also, I would never begrudge somebody the desire and the pursuit of really digging into form if they want to. But I think what I'm hearing from you is, if that's the only thing or if that's the barrier for entry, not a whole lot of people are going to be entering that building.
Right. We have people who just have a natural tendency to want to analyze and understand how things are put together. And then you have other people who love like a kind of a more holistic approach. There's nothing wrong with the academy or intellectuals. I'm saying that poetry is not just limited to that spectrum.
Mm-hmm. Al, you agree?
Absolutely. I mean, I was thinking to myself as Banke was talking about how our intuitive responses are probably the most exciting responses that we have to poetry. And they're the ones that I try, when I teach students, try to encourage them to study that first and explore that and examine what it is that they're responding to and why a poem excites them or why a line excites them in some way. I think an emotional response, an intuitive one, is a totally legitimate approach to examining or studying poetry.
There's a couple of events that we should make sure our listeners know about, and that's the peg for this discussion here. Craig's going to be reading from The Trembling Answers tomorrow at 6 p.m. at Fuego Coffee Roasters in Rochester. It's free. It's open to the public. They'll have books there available for purchase. A partnership between Writers and Books, Read Local Series, and BOA Edition. So that's tomorrow, 6 p.m. I know, Al, you're looking forward to that.
Absolutely. Both events are really exciting. I mean, being able to hear Craig read his beautiful poems, as well as Breathing Fire, it's hard to choose, really. Having watched the teens over the past few months develop and perform these, you know, really courageous, really expressive, exciting poems.
All right, so hold on. So he mentioned a second event there. So Craig's reading that I mentioned at
it's
Fuego.
It's exciting.
Craig's reading I mentioned at Fuego is at 6 p.m., yep. Free and open to the public. At 6:30, he mentioned Breathing Fire, the Grand Slam. That is at 6:30 at Bread and Water Theater on West Main Street. Youth poets are performing there?
Yes. Yes. It's for poets ages 13 to 19, mostly high school students from around the area. We have a couple of college students who are participating. Some of them have been participating for like 3 years now in the program, so they've really emerged as young poets in the process.
Okay. Is his master class filled up, or any space for that?
There's still plenty of space.
All right. So tomorrow from 10 to noon, at Writers and Books, it's Craig's masterclass, Sonnet as Argument with Myself. What are you going to be talking about, Craig?
Well, I mean, a sonnet is a little structured box in which you can, it's small, but you can have a little conversation with yourself in it. And it's sort of built so you can do that. So we'll be talking about how that happens and how to make that happen.
All right. So 10 to noon. And if you want to register and get involved, Al, how do they do that?
You can contact Writers and Books. You can also visit our website. You can register for the class online as well.
Craig, can I ask you to read? You can choose whatever you like.
Yeah,
I'll hand
sure.
you the book here. We've been digging through it. I'm just going to hand it right over to him. Yeah, you can choose whatever you like there. But before you do that, just a broader question. You know, when you put a book of poetry together, are you looking for a general thread or a theme, a section of your life, an emotional current, or not?
I mean, I think when most poets put books together, poets write poems, right? We don't really write books. And
right.
then you have, after some period of time, you stick them together. But what ends up happening is it ends up being a record of whatever you were thinking about or obsessed with or interested in over a period of time. I mean, for this book, most of it, you know, it's about, the oldest poems are about 5 years old, and a lot of them deal with a time when my son was very medicalized, and so that comes out of that and then kind of goes other places.
Okay. Well, what would you like to read for us then?
Well, I guess I'll read the second poem, which is called Self-Portrait Beside Myself. Which is a poem about my son has severe cerebral palsy, and he is fed through a G-tube. You know, it's a tube in his tummy that we pour liquid food into. Mm-hmm. And so this is a poem about feeding him at night while he's sleeping. Self-portrait beside myself. We've been lucky. March is over, and my son is still alive. My daughter is about to crawl, and the golden sunset light recalls distant childhood light. I feed my son while he sleeps through a hole in his tummy when the night nurse has the night off. And when I go to the mirror, it's to see if the ocean-eyed man, the teenager I was, had hoped to become, is anywhere in there. The teenager is. He wants you to see him, help him. Tell him he's strong and gently dramatic. He wants to be part of a story, even if not a true one. He wants to have sex like mad, even if I don't. Standing over my son at night, I feel quiet. Only then, no need to be me or anyone, just listening to him breathe. I can divide all life into breath and waiting for the next breath. And the calm in the troughs between. I wanted to show you I could see the world without me in the way. I can't, not even for a little while. I'm beside that man watching over his son, impressed with him and his humility. But if that's what it takes to keep my son safe, admiring my better self rather than being him, then okay, that's okay.
It's Craig Morgan Teicher. And the name of that poem was
Self-Portrait Beside Myself.
Self-Portrait Beside Myself. I almost wish I had a copy of the text in front of me as you read, because I find it so fascinating to hear poets read their own work in, you know, sort of your own voice, and then the cadence that, you know, as you flow through it. Is it interesting for you to hear other people read your work and to kind of hear how they interpret the choice to how to present it, where the starts and stops are?
Well, one of the things that I do when I teach poetry workshops is whenever a poem's up for workshop, someone else reads it so that the poet can hear it in someone else's voice to hear how, how the words might feel kind of outside of their own head. It's very strange to hear that.
And as I listened there, I found myself wondering, did you write that for you or did you write it for an audience? Because I felt connected to the work that you're doing as a parent, the certain common parental concerns that I may have that may not mirror exactly yours because my son may not be going through what your son is, but there's certain things I could connect to and there's certain things I could just appreciate. But was it more for you or was it for an audience?
I mean, finally, by the time it becomes part of a book, you know, I hope it's an aesthetic object that's out in the world, but I feel like the process of writing a poem is very distant and different from the process of publishing it, you know? I mean, so to get the poem written, I mean, of course, to get it written, I think a writer has to imagine an audience, right? That there has to be somebody to whom you're speaking because it's a art form about communicating with an imaginary person, you know, and so you have to imagine that person. But once it gets to real people, it's very different from that private process of imagining the audience that you want to be heard by.
That's interesting. It's not all that unlike what I think I heard Banke Awope 2 tell Open Mic about Always Want More, when you said that was the book that you always wanted to read. So if it doesn't exist, I'm going to write it. So in a sense, that was for you.
Absolutely.
But then, you know, is it really for an audience or is it for you first?
It's for myself. It's for me first. But then the thought that there was something that I wanted and wasn't out there, it let me know that there was an audience that was looking for the thing as well. Because I think typically when we think about our own interests and that kind of like insular process, we would like to believe that it's, you know, just specific to us. But it's not. There are other people who kind of have the same checks or the same experiences. And now being the owner of my company, I'm thinking marketing. So even the publishing process and the writing process is different. But when it comes to marketing, you're trying to find that audience that connects to those things that are fundamentally the same. Mm-hmm. So when you just said as a parent, you connected. One of the lines that he said, I'm like, oh, I had to find, because I do still, we're in agreement on this. When you said that you are admiring him instead of being him, and kind of like this idea of being set aside from yourself, I think that's really powerful. And I'm sure that there are so many people could hear that and connect to it as well.
Well, they both touched on, Banke and Craig just touched on how publishing may impact art. I want to revisit that in just one moment, but Al, I also want to ask you, how much poetry are you writing these days? And if you are writing poetry, again, more for you or more for, you know, to express to others?
Right now I'm in the middle of a 30-30 challenge because it is National Poetry Month. And I think a lot of poets are familiar with the concept, but for those who aren't, it's basically the challenge is to write a poem a day for the month of April. And so right now I am writing quite a bit of poetry. And I try to make it a regular practice as much as I can. As far as, I'm sorry, what was the other part of the question?
Well, first of all, let me just interrupt and say, if we're writing limericks about what a bad guy Chris Fanning is, that does not count. It has to be other stuff. But I wanted to ask if that is for you. I mean, if your poetry is first and foremost for you.
I guess I would have to say yes. I mean, I don't know anybody else's tastes except my own, really. I'd hope in some way that the work would connect with other audiences in some way. But I'm writing to my own interests and my own concerns. I mean, I think of poetry as largely a spiritual practice for me. It's a way for me to process the world around me, to understand some sort of experience. And I think that's the best I can do is just write for myself.
So, Al, I'll follow up with you and I'll kick this over to everybody. This sounds to me like you can find parallels with, I'll take my brother, for example. My twin brother is a wonderful songwriter and probably has written more songs than he could ever imagine that, of course, are not all going to be picked up by labels, all that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So he's writing because he wants to write. Sometimes he writes just to get it out of him, you know, mm-hmm. and then that artistic impulse. When the industry, with a big eye, comes into play, they usually say things like, we need a little bit more of a hook with this. You know, we need something that's a little bit more repetitive. Can we dumb it down a little? You know, or we would publish this record if you can add a hit to it that's a little simpler, you know? And there's something that feels crude about that. And I imagine, I don't know, we're going to find out in a second, if the publishing world with poetry is kind of the same way, that they say, well, that's nice, but, you know, is... is there something that we can do with this, or, you know, do we have to manipulate it in some way? And how much of that can you part with? You know, what do you aspire to do with your poetry, and what happens if it starts to go into different places?
Oh, man, that's a big one. That's a big question. So I think one of the things about poetry, because it's such a niche genre, because there aren't as many people, I feel, really paying attention to it, that there's a lot of freedom to do a lot of different things within the genre of poetry. I do think that I do believe in the necessity of a strong editorial eye. I think when you're taking a look at a collection of poetry, when you're looking at any sort of manuscript, you do look for things like overall arc, thematic cohesion, all these different elements for a good collection. I don't know of many presses, and I could be wrong, and maybe others could pipe in about this, but where an editor will or a publisher will approach it cynically and say, "Well, you know, this collection's really kind of a downer. Could you make it a little happier?"
Yeah.
You know, I just don't see that really happening in poetry, as opposed to other genres. But I don't know if others have noticed something similar as well.
Okay, Greg.
Well, yeah, poetry in America is largely published on a nonprofit basis. I mean, there isn't really an industry in that way. There's an infrastructure, and so you with poetry there isn't that kind of market mandate in order to publish a book. It just needs to be good. You know, that does happen with the big New York publishers of you know, with prose, where they are certainly concerned with making back the money they've paid and making a profit, but that doesn't really happen with poetry, which means that it can be aesthetically motivated, you know, the poetry business, such as it is, which is nice. I mean, and certainly I think if any editor were to say, "Well, I'm not going to publish sad poetry books," that would pretty much dry up the well.
But when you say then, Craig, that the act of writing a poem is very different than the act of publishing a poem, then tell me a little bit more about what you mean.
Well, you know, as Al said, I think for poets, poetry ends up being a spiritual practice. And I don't know that necessarily self-expression is for me where it starts. I mean, of course it is, but it's also about, you know, a lifelong commitment to making these funny little objects out of words that have become important to me for lots of reasons that I can't really articulate quickly. You know, so that happens, and when writing, I'm not necessarily thinking about, you know, what colors are going to be on the cover and who's going to buy it and who's going to read it. By the time I get to the point where I'm putting together a book, the poems are largely sort of dead to me. I mean, I can't fix them anymore. I can't. I mean, I think of them as toys when I'm writing them. You know, that they're, and I can move pieces around and have a lot of fun playing with them. By the time they get here, they're old toys that are not for me anymore. And I want to write new poems that I can play with.
Okay. Banke?
I love that. Words as toys. Again, I'm not a published poet, but a published author. Mm-hmm. And so I think you guys mentioned that when it comes to that genre, that is something that the industry likes to kind of push in one direction or the other. I tried to go that traditional industry route for 3 years. And the difficulty that I had was people were telling me my book was either too sophisticated to be considered urban fiction or too urban to be considered commercial or mainstream. So they were telling me to kind of push it in one way or the other. So if I wanted to keep these urban elements, take away all the social issues, you know, add more cursing and sex, you know, or if I wanted to include those cursing and sex because it was authentic to the story, then I needed to try to repackage it. And so that's what kind of encouraged me or inspired me to create my own company, because, again, thinking of what I wanted to read and knowing women like myself, and a lot of times when you're talking about a white industry and black art form, they don't understand the audience. And so that has really been my advantage because I am the audience.
Well, and you know, it's one thing if you have to weigh as a writer, are these suggestions pragmatic, but can we make these changes without losing the soul of the work?
Exactly.
Or is this just going to distill this into everything else that's on the marketplace?
Exactly.
You know, and it sounds like you made a choice, that you thought was better for your work?
Absolutely. And again, with words being toys, I was 25 when I wrote the bulk of my novel. And so I'm working on my second one now. I don't even like to really talk about the first one anymore. Like, I'm so over it. But I do want you to buy it, though. Thank you.
We're talking, it's National Poetry Month, and our panel is talking about a number of different related topics. By the way, listeners, I didn't mention the phone number, but we'd love to hear from you. You know, what do you think about poetry in general? I know it's sort of a lame question, but what I mean by that is there's a number of different things we could talk about here. You know, how often do you read poetry? Do you feel like you don't read it enough, frankly? Are your kids in school? Are they learning it? Are they learning the forms? Are they simply reading it? You can call the program. It's 844-295-TALK. That's toll free, 844-295-8255. Or 263-WXXI if you're calling from Rochester, 263-9994. Go ahead, Bunke.
Because the question you asked is how often do you read poetry?
Yeah.
I'm curious to how often do people experience poetry? Because it may be in seeing it performed or even when you're thinking about social media. I've been posting, you know, with the 30 for 30 little poems on Instagram, follow at Bunke the author, shameless plug. But again, we are coming across poetry in different mediums than was traditionally looked at as reading poetry. So I'll be interested to hear from the callers, how often are you experiencing poetry and how?
Yeah, that's a very, very good question. I see the phone ringing. Before we get to the phones, I do want to ask all of our guests a question on, you know, forget whether they're writing for themselves or for the audience. I am curious to know if they would be bothered if the audience is interpreting or receiving a poem maybe differently than it was crafted. And think about this. What is the single most well-known poem in this country's history by an order of magnitude? It's The Road Not Taken by Robert Frost. The name of the poem is The Road Not Taken. It's not The Road Less Traveled By. And and most people think it is something that Robert Frost never intended it to be. Robert Frost wrote that poem for a friend who could never make up his mind, and he was sarcastically poking fun at the way that we like to look back in our life and say, "Oh man, I took the hard road. Good for me. Pat yourself on the back." Mm. You know, when you're talking at dinner parties to friends about what a brave person you are, when in reality, two roads that morning equally lay. They were the same sort of thing. And years later, you'd be like, "Well, I took the hard one." No, you didn't. But you like to convince yourself. And what happens now? Well, that poem is interpreted totally differently. And I don't know that matters or not, because sometimes people think, well, when a poem is out in the world, people are going to receive it how they receive it, and that's up to them. Or, Craig, does it matter to you if someone is receiving things and you go, wait a second, that's not where I was going with this?
Well, I mean, of course, it's a you know, a poem has a writer and a reader. I mean, that's part of the imaginative contract that you need to make one. So, of course, you can't control what happens on the other side of that contract. And yet, I think a good poet's job is to create the poem in such a way that the reader can't quite get it wrong, you know? Mm-hmm. Which is not to say that, I mean, Frost poems are all, not all, I mean, they're all perfect. you know, you want to make sure you have the stuff in the poem so that an attentive reader can read it and hear you, you know, and hear what it is you were trying to get them to hear. But also a good poet writes a poem in such a way that the poet knows that the poet isn't necessarily hearing him or herself entirely without the help of the reader.
Hmm.
So there's some open ends.
That's a fascinating way to describe it. Al,
what time is your master class?
Yeah, I know. Al, what do you think? It's 10 o'clock, by the way. It's the master class. Writers and books.
Please do. When it comes to how people interpret my work, I mean, I don't know, any number of workshops, I've had that experience of being misunderstood. And there's a part of me that finds that exciting when someone finds something that I hadn't observed before in the writing, that sees something, some pattern, some gesture, some even theme that I had never really considered. And I don't really find it frustrating anymore so much as revealing. You know, it's you're sort of putting yourself out into a vulnerable position whenever you release your work. And, you know, there's going to be things about yourself and your writing, habits or whatever, that you don't recognize until someone else points it out for you. So as far as having other people look at my work and have their own ideas about it, I'm all for it.
All right, if you're on the phone and I see three lines buzzing, we're going to get you in just a second. But Bunke, you want to weigh in that as well?
I forgot what the question was.
No, just a question on if the audience is receiving your work differently than you intended, is that okay?
Yes.
Yes.
I'm an educator, so, you know, student-centered, right? And as a businesswoman, I believe that the reader is always right. I've had people, you know, I've gotten some very stinging critiques, but
again, the reader can be wrong. Come on.
No, the reader cannot be wrong. Please buy the book. but I've gotten stinging critiques, but in listening to Al, really what stung me was that it was a reflection of things about myself and my writing that were kind of that needed to be brought to the light. Regardless if I agree still to this point, mm-hmm. I appreciate getting that feedback because that's where growth starts.
Well, you know, I think the funny thing about writing is that it really, if you're doing it right, what you're doing is you're crafting a mirror, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, but that mirror is in part made of this imaginary reader. So the unfortunate thing about mirrors is you don't get to pick what you see in them, you know? Mm-hmm. You can try to edit, but you don't get to pick what you see. And again, a good artist is somebody who knows how to get him or herself out of the way so that what's really there in the art appears in the mirror or something. But also, I always think the other thing is, well, okay, being misread, that's maybe annoying, but gosh, I'm just glad to be read, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, and to feel like somebody's trying to figure out what's being said there at all. Because the whole point of poetry is that there's something you want to say that there's no one to say it to.
I take the point. And this is why we love these programs, by the way. You bring in really thoughtful artists, writers, creators, and just get to hear them talk about their craft. You're hearing Craig Morgan Teicher, who's the author of the collection of poems, The Trembling Answers. And Craig is going to be here, well, for the weekend. There's some events coming up after this break. We'll tell you more about that. Also here is Al Abinado, who's a poet and director of adult programs at Writers and Books, and Banke Awupe 2 has written poetry. She's also a novelist, and her book is Always Want More. She's an educator. We're talking about the craft, and we're going to get your phone calls coming up here. So Bill in Brighton, Ricky in Rochester, we're coming to you. If you want to call the program, it's 844-295-TALK, toll free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. We're back after this short break, and I'll tell you what's coming up on Monday on The Next Connections. We talked to Robin Given, who's a fashion editor for The Washington Post. She became the first fashion writer to win a Pulitzer Prize with fashion criticism of Dick Cheney and what he wore to Auschwitz, and among other things. Really interesting. So we're going to talk to her about her work as a fashion critic. Then in our second hour, how are we teaching students about climate literacy? We'll discuss several approaches being used throughout our community. That's on Monday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. You can meet Craig Morgan Teicher. He's going to be reading from his collection of poems, The Trembling Answers, tomorrow, 6 p.m. at Fuego Coffee Roasters. It's free and open to the public. Books are going to be there available for purchase. But before then, if you want, you can go tomorrow morning, 10 a.m. to noon, for a masterclass with Craig at Writers and Books called The Sonnet as an Argument with Myself. So that's something you can register for. Jump on wab.org.
Yes.
If you want to learn more about that. Also tomorrow at 6:30 p.m., so kind of happening concurrently as the Fuego event, is the Breathing Fire. And it is youth poets performing. That's going to be at the Bread and Water Theater on West Main Street. So a lot going on this weekend. Let me get to your phone calls. Nick in Gates first up. Go ahead, Nick.
Hi. Thanks for featuring me here. And I just wanted to say also, there's a chance I might be able to make the sonnet workshop, so I look forward to that.
Awesome.
And looking into that. I just wanted to comment a couple steps back here. You mentioned the popularity of poetry and the challenges that faces in today's culture, I guess. I remember in college I had a professor who painted the picture of the poet Lord Byron in his time being able to wake up as what was called a rock star by the professor. He was able to walk by his book, Child Harold's Pilgrimage, when it was published, and see it in every storefront. And he found himself to be the rock star, the celebrity of his time, because poetry was just such a centralized art form that everyone was reading. Teenagers were reading. Girls were hiding under their beds. Guys were hiding and reading in their spare time. Do any of you see that happening again?
We're pulling poetry back to the mainstream. Nick, thanks for the phone call, and I know they'll see you tomorrow morning here. Craig, are we going to pull poetry back to the mainstream like that?
Well, I mean, we have a much more fragmented entertainment culture right now. Mm. I mean, poetry, we're in a golden age of poetry publishing and poetry readership right now. There's so many creative writing programs for students of all ages that I think there are more people reading poetry than probably there ever have been. Mm. And of course, there are more people who are literate than there ever have been. I think Lord Byron probably would have faced some challenges around literacy, beyond his social milieu.
So we might be seeing like an idealized version of what it was like in Lord Byron's time.
Yeah, I would think. Although, I mean, you know, I agree that he was something of a rock star in his time. But, I do think, and it's like publications like BuzzFeed now publish poetry. Mm-hmm. The New York Times is publishing poetry in the Sunday Magazine. I mean, there's certainly more of it than there was before. It is a niche art form. I mean, but there's versions of it in all kinds of places where there weren't before.
Okay, and I don't mean to be the wet blanket, but the National Endowment for the Arts has reported that poetry reading among Americans declined from 12% to 7% between 2002 and 2012. And if you want to go all the way back to 1982, 20% of Americans were reading poetry with some regularity in 1982. Again, it's 7% today. But to Craig's point, literacy rates are, in most of the world higher than ever before. And so there's more entertainment choices. So you're not necessarily going to see poetry on every street corner, but that doesn't mean that people aren't reading. Fair?
Yeah. I mean, even if the raw numbers are down, there's this incredibly vital and rather vast community of people who are involved in American poetry right now. And I have to think that it's sort of more vital than it was.
Okay. Al, any thoughts for Nick there on bringing poetry back more to the mainstream?
I mean, there's always this conversation that, like you mentioned earlier, that comes up about how, humanities are dying, or the NEA reports are always emerging about the decline in poetry readership. I don't know. I'm skeptical myself about those kinds of reports. I feel like, when we even look at things at social media, whether it's like Tumblr or Instagram, where poetry seems to proliferate in these different mediums. So I wonder, where these numbers are coming from. As far as like getting it into the mainstream, Craig mentioned a couple of great examples. The New York Times and BuzzFeed are championing poetry, but we're also seeing it in unusual places, on subways, on buses. Mm-hmm. There are all these great, exciting ways that poetry is being introduced into the mainstream.
Okay.
I think sometimes with the publishing industry, we don't catch up to the different ways, again, that people are experiencing poetry. So what are those raw numbers based on? Is it, is it people who bought poetry books or whatever? Because to your point, again, there are different platforms that, is getting poetry is going directly to the people.
That's a really important point. I have no idea how they measure those numbers. And from 1982 to 2012, the way we consume changed a lot.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's a great point. Well, Craig, you want to add to that?
Yeah, last Friday I did an amazing event in Grand Central Station that was sponsored the Poetry Society of America and the MTA, called The Poet Is In, where they actually set up a whole room with desks and typewriters and had six poets at a time writing personalized poems for anybody who came along. And there was a line out the door the whole day. And I wrote poems in an hour for about 12 people who were all just deeply and wildly excited to have somebody sit there and write poems for them. And I'm sure a lot of those people, don't own a library of poetry, but they were certainly deeply excited to receive a poem and to read it, and felt like, it was a surprisingly sort of generous and inspiring thing to do, just to see all these people who wanted poems.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, let me get back to the phones, because I know other listeners want to weigh in. Bill in Brighton next. Go ahead, Bill.
This is such an important program you're having in this hour. Poetry, to me, is something that has to be in my world, even though I'm a woefully ignorant of the vast amount of poetry being written. But, for example, Garrison Keillor's Writer's Almanac, The New Yorker publishes two excellent poems each week. And the one thing I have found out in my 79 young years, this is an intimate art, the art of poetry. And you can't just read it. You have to speak it. So I beg your listeners, the next time you read a poem, speak it and see how the intimacy comes to you. That's why we go to readings, to hear poets recite their own poetry. God bless you for what you're doing.
Oh, Bill, that's very sweet. Thank you very much. You agree with that, Craig, on reading it like that way out loud?
Yeah. I certainly, when I'm writing, I'm imagining it spoken, you know, and my favorite poems, I do just sort of cuddle up and read them to myself out loud. It's based on a verbal art form. I mean, the poetry as we know it now has its roots in completely oral, art. And so it's about talking to people, to oneself as another person. So, yeah.
Okay, Al?
I agree in the importance of reading or speaking or hearing other poets read their work. I know even as part of the process of writing, I'll read it out loud. I just want the mouthfeel to hear it, to read it to somebody else, to gauge their reaction. And there's something intimate about that experience, you know, when you're listening to someone read their own work.
Do you ever have that happen and you think, boy, out loud, it's different, and do you find yourself sort of editing in that way?
Mm-hmm.
You
absolutely,
do?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Yeah. Banke?
Absolutely. Again, writing is a spiritual process. It's Good Friday, right? Words are containers of power. And so you have to be able to speak those things out loud. That's the whole point.
All right, back to the phones. Ricky in Rochester wants to discuss the music of poetry. Go ahead, Ricky.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me on. I got inspired from that last segment that you did. So I opened up a bottle of red wine and talking poetry now.
It's a very good Friday here on Connections. There you
indeed,
go.
Indeed.
Indeed. No, I was, I don't know if I like traditionally read a lot of poetry as I should, but I was interested about music and lyrics being poems. Like I was thinking of, you can go back to like the Psalms of King David, that's music. Or I like Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, that's Ode to Joy is Frederick Schiller's work, or even just recently the Nobel Prize went to a guy that, you know, I guess writes poetry in the lyric form, or something as simple as just yesterday I was listening to something like Blink 182, which is, you know, is punk music, but the lyrics are, they're poetry when you read them out loud. Mm-hmm. I mean, I just thought this is really interesting way of maybe reaching people to read more, you know. All the Small Things, it's a song that I think is about, you know, Nixon opening up China in 72. So it has a lot of neat meaning to it. What do you guys think? Is there music that you find to be poetry?
Hip-hop.
Yeah, I mean, I'll just say Paul on Twitter just said, come on, guys, poetry every day, rap music. Banke?
Yeah, when somebody asked a question about the poet being the rock star, like, that's, I thought of Kendrick Lamar. Like, everybody, I mean, his album dropped, and this is a man who is undoubtedly a poet. So, again, I think that we just have to be just fluid in understanding the different ways that poetry is infused in so many different art forms.
Okay, Al?
I agree with what Monkey said. I mean, I think hip-hop was the first thing that came to mind. Actually, when you mentioned Kendrick Lamar, there's a great video that Vox put out about scanning the lines in rap songs and how they work meter and how they use different literary devices in their lyrics. And I thought it was a really eye-opening for those who are even skeptical about that.
Okay. Greg?
Well, I mean, absolutely. Though I think that the interesting thing is that with music, with lyrics, they're built differently because you have the song to communicate, you have the music to communicate some of the emotional information. Whereas in a poem, the words have to be both the song and the music. I love Bob Dylan. He's so deeply central to my whole life. But I think he won the Nobel not for his lyrics, but for his songs, meaning the lyrics as set to music and that particular music that they were set to, and his great breadth of knowledge about the history of folk song forms. And all of that stuff is encoded into the song, and all of that history also has to be encoded into the poem without the song.
So. We derailed an entire hour talking about whether Dylan should have gotten that award, by the way.
Yeah,
do you want to weigh in on that?
I'm happy about it.
Okay.
I mean, but, you know, all over the world in the last, you know, especially that week, many of us derailed many hours.
Yeah, I know. That's a great point. That's great. And Ricky, that was a great phone call. Thanks for listening today. I really appreciate that. Let me get back to your phone calls. Look at what poetry has done. Who says poetry is dead? The whole world's calling Connections to talk about poetry. David in Rochester. Go ahead, David.
Hey, I agree with a lot of what just the last question and response. Poetry is not just talking. There's all kinds of structure in it. There's meter and rhyme. And, it, you know, there is a lyrical pattern in poetry that's worked and reworked and reworked. Poetry is not something normal any more than finger painting is considered a fine art. Poetry is not finger painting. Poetry is, of course, to be enjoyed by as many as can, but there's also a requirement to put in your time, put in your effort, besides the proverbial, you know, self-flush that comes early on in the finger paint metaphor. There's also the reference to developing your craft, developing the understanding of how you can put the music into your words and how to structure it. There's a lot of effort, and that's not even talking about revision. as I'm sure, Al, you know, mm-hmm. Craig, I don't know, but I'm sure you do.
Well,
so there you have it.
David, thank you. You know, Al, apparently you know David a little bit. You want to add to some of that?
I'm just going to agree with what he said. I mean, I think, you know, there is more, obviously, to poetry than just a bunch of words on the page. I mean, it has to pass a smell test, there has to be some sort of pattern making, some kind of quality to it that elevates it.
All right. So, again, we could totally derail with this, but this is the age-old debate that people have, like, is that art? You know, I mean, like, I don't even know how I feel about these kind of debates, but what you're saying is you think there's at least some baseline before you can call something poetry.
I think so, to a degree. I mean, it's one of those hard things, and, if you were going to push me and say, is this poetry, is that poetry, I mean, I think it would take me some time to come up with a cohesive formula to apply to any sort of writing, but I think there is a limit, I guess, to what can be considered poems and what can't be. But
all right, Craig, I mean, there's no question when you read Ogden Nash's The Cow, it's a poem. The cow is of the bovine ilk. One end is moo, the other milk. That's a poem. But others are kind of maybe a little bit more nebulous or a little less conventional. Do you draw lines?
Well, I mean, of course, but a big part of my life is being someone who writes about poetry, and I love and I'm obsessed with poetry's long tradition, all of the mechanics, all the things you can make words do musically and rhythmically, and all the things that are communicated by those patterns and rhythms and rhymes. At the same time, I think I would make a distinction between, poems and poetry, meaning that maybe there are ways of engaging with your imagination and language that you are writing poetry, and then maybe you stop short of finally making a kind of lasting aesthetic object because that was never your intent. I don't know. Whereas I think there are poems that self-consciously engage with the long tradition of poetry in English and other languages and send signals that they're aware of those older poems and older forms. And that's, that's one form of poetry, and maybe it's a more elite form of poetry, but it's certainly, I mean, it ends up being the one that I've built my life around. Although there are lots of ways to engage with poetry.
Okay, Banke.
I agree that in order to consider something poetry or a person a poet, there has to be a particular respect and investment in the craft. I do kind of take the opposite perspective of the caller, though, in that I think in starting with that talk, that conversation of what is poetry, like what are the requirements of it, I believe it's a very elitist train of thought. And I think that sometimes as artists, we adopt this snobbery because we suffer for our art and we want to believe that only this, elite tribe can do it. But that's part of the reason why we do have to suffer so much for our art, because we end up being so exclusionary and in that way.
Okay, let me get back to your phone calls and Stephanie and Victor. Go ahead, Stephanie.
Hi. One of my most wonderful memories when my husband and I visited Ireland years ago was in Dublin, and there was a street poet there. He was reciting and charging for each poem that he recited, mostly Irish poetry.
Oh, we
Oh, we lost you, Stephanie. We were in the middle of a great story about Three Points. call back and finish the story. I would love to see that, by the way. But while we're waiting for that, I'll go to Mike in Fairport, who wants to talk about not only a book related to Lord Byron's daughter, but a digital future. Go ahead, Mike.
Hi, yeah, I just finished the book that I really enjoyed. I'm not a reader of poetry, but I was fascinated to learn about Lord Byron, and especially about his daughter, Ada Lovelace, who was a visionary that in the early 1800s, she foresaw a digital future, a digitization of music and sound and lots of things. It's a wonderful book. But not written in poetry.
Mike, thanks very much for that. I'm looking at the clock, and I've got only a few minutes left, and I want to hit a couple of subjects. We could have probably done this all day, but I wanted to ask Craig, who we've been talking about Craig Morgan Teicher as an author, as a poet, as the man who wrote the book, and The Trembling Answers, which is what he's going to be reading from tomorrow night at Fuego. But you're also somebody who writes, as you said, about poetry. And we opened the hour talking about how, you know, people like me who doesn't have a whole lot of training in it might occasionally feel a little reticent to weigh in on whether a poem is quote-unquote good or effective. And I think you all gave really gracious, inclusive answers for that. On that, essentially saying, you know, don't feel intimidated if you don't have that kind of background and training. But I'm curious to know, Craig, you know, how you decide to, you know, do you bifurcate it? Do you say, I'm going to first write about this poetry and how it hits me, just the reaction to it, whether I like it, whether I can feel something from it, and then I'll also take a look at the form and look at structure. Do you do it different ways in different settings? How do you do it?
Well, you know, going back to something that Al said a while back, you know, one's intuitive responses are pretty much always the starting point for any articulation of what's going on in a literary text. I mean, so basically what I try to do as a critic is, I mean, I've tried to learn how to listen to my intuitive responses and then be articulate about them in a way that will reach whatever audience I'm writing for. So I tend to write about poetry for newspapers. And so that's, you know, you're writing for a general interest audience, whoever might pick up the newspaper, you want them to be able to start in on the article and understand what you're talking about. So I'm trying to make my intuitive responses, which I hope are sophisticated, accessible. Mm. But I mean, basically, I'm trying to describe what is pleasurable or not about these poems and what are some ways that a reader can engage with those pleasures. And and then eventually you do get into the formal aspects of the poems and the, you know, the kind of deeper aspects, but I try to explain them in such a way that even if you don't have a master's degree in poetry, you can understand it by looking down at the page and seeing what's there.
I would appreciate that as a reader of yours. So, no, that's very interesting. I'd like all of you, if you could, to weigh in on what the Atlantic Monthly wrote in their piece, Why Teaching Poetry is So Important. And here from the Atlantic Monthly, they write the following, quote, "Poetry enables teachers to teach their students how to write, read, and understand any text. Poetry can give students a healthy outlet for surging emotions. Reading original poetry aloud in class can foster trust and empathy in the classroom community, while also emphasizing speaking and listening skills that are often neglected in high school literature classes. Students who don't like writing essays may like poetry, with its dearth of fixed rules and its kinship with rap. For these students, poetry can become a gateway to other forms of writing. It can help teach skills that come in handy with other kinds of writing, like precise, economical diction, as just one example," end quote. Mm-hmm. Bunke, you agree with that?
Completely. And again, that's why I keep kind of trumping this accessibility, because that's the whole point. If we're talking about numbers of people reading poetry being down, then we as lovers of the art and for educators specifically, we have to be able to integrate it in a way that is alive and fresh. And there's no better way than to just kind of allow young people to experiment, manipulate the poetry, and see all the different doors that can open up. I had an amazing, this is an aside, but I had an amazing student named Sabine Bradley, who was like killing the literary scene. And she's been phenomenal since she was in the eighth grade. And having that ability to be encouraged in class and to have your talent appreciated in such a way, I mean, I think 10 years from now, yeah, she's going to be something serious.
And she wasn't forced into a box that was too restrictive early in her life.
No, you can't put that girl in a box.
No, that's good. That's good. Al?
I mean, I agree with what Bunke said as well as what the Atlantic had said. You know, poetry in many ways, especially for young people, is a way to reclaim the world. I think it's a way for them to articulate their concerns, to express their needs. And, you know, we do that obviously through language, and poetry provides them with these tools that allow them to do these things. So, I mean, not only is it useful for making them better readers or writers, but also, you know, more empathetic and better humans overall.
Okay, Craig.
And, you know, we talk a lot in creative writing education about, you know, finding your voice. And I think that's sort of a fancy way of simply saying learning to have the ability to say what you want to say in a way that will be clear and understood by other people. And no matter what somebody wants to do after they're done with their education, I mean, being able to understand what you think and put it into words is going to make them more confident and happier and more able to get what they want out of the world. Also, you know, gosh, poetry's fun. It's one of the few things that gets taught in school that you can... You can be irreverent, you can be mean, you can be funny, you can, you know, bring all these things together that I think when people get nervous about, oh, I got a poem wrong, or teacher, I mean, I think a lot of teachers get nervous that they're going to teach poetry wrong, and so they teach it in a really cursory manner. That's really terrible because you can't really get it wrong.
Well, you think about the amount of disclaimers we've heard in this hour. So many people who have called in, I'm not a poetry expert. Even myself, I think I've said four times, I'm not a poet. And it's that idea that you feel like if you claim this word, you have to do it a particular way.
Yep.
It's very limiting.
Well, it's been a great hour. And I just want to thank our guests and let our listeners know, again, you got a great chance this weekend to participate, to listen, to kind of check out the scene. Tomorrow morning from 10 to noon, Craig is teaching a masterclass at Writers and Books, WAB.org. If you want to check that out, and you can still register, he's going to be giving a free reading tomorrow, 6 p.m. at Fuego Coffee Roasters in Rochester. That'll be a great scene. And 6:30 at Bread and Water Theater on West Main, youth poets performing at Breathing Fire Grand Slam. Craig Morgan Teicher, great stuff. Thank you so much for coming in this hour.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And Al Abinato from Writers and Books. Thanks, Al.
Thanks again.
And Bunke Wupe Tu, the author of Always Want More. We'll come back and talk book publishing and what you're doing here in Rochester
awesome.
On a separate day.
I've been waiting for that.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Have a great weekend, everyone. We'll talk to you Monday.